Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The gunshots and explosions, the tanks and deserted streets remain the sounds and images of the Middle East. Latest reports in from Bethlehem say the Church of the Nativity remains under siege. There is furious gunfire in refugee camps in Nablus, the West Bank's biggest city, where Israeli tanks moved in late last night. Arafat still sits in his damaged headquarters in Ramallah. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon is scheduled to meet with U.S. Envoy Anthony Zinni. And 7 days into Israel's Operation Defensive Shield, Bethlehem, Ramallah, Nablus, Beit Jala, Tulkarm, Qalqilya, Salfit, and Jenin have all come under Israeli control. International pressure tightens on the United States to actually do something beyond hoping for a ceasefire. Connection listeners, what kind of steps do you think the Bush administration should take to end the death and the destruction and desperation in the Middle East and to make way for peace? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us a little bit later in the program, William Quant, professor of government and foreign affairs at the University of Virginia and former member of the National Security Council during the Nixon and Carter administrations. And starting out with us, Henry Siegman, Middle East expert and senior fellow at the Council of Foreign Relations in New York City, and Jean Kirkpatrick, senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. We will start with David Sanger. He is White House correspondent for the New York Times. And David, when I looked at the web page for the Guardian newspaper in Britain and saw one of their stories, what the U.S. papers are saying, I thought to myself, aha, now, this is a time when the world is turning its attention to exactly what Washington's going to do and whether or not there'll be a change. Are you watching for that as each day goes by?
Well, we are, and if you see today's Times or our website, you'll see that our lead story today says that the administration is beginning, in fact, to very slowly, a few degrees at a time, change its policy. Until yesterday, what we heard consistently was the president saying you had to start with a security plan and a total ceasefire, and then there would be the beginnings of what he calls the Mitchell Plan, named, of course, for former Senator George Mitchell, which is the first steps toward a political discussion. That clearly wasn't happening. It was a formula that was devised for different and more peaceful times. And now we saw yesterday, first at the White House and then with an interview that Secretary of State Colin Powell gave, the movement toward a faster political discussions, perhaps even while the violence is still going on. The theory of this is that there's no incentive for the Palestinians to stop the violence if they don't think that there is going to be a serious political talk. The downside is that a lot of conservatives within Mr. Bush's own party have been urging him to do the opposite, that he should support Mr. Sharon completely and support a crushing of the Palestinian Authority.
Now, that's your beat. You know the officials in the White House. What's the sense that you're picking up, David, about how he is being torn between those people who are urging him to stand more squarely behind Sharon and those people saying, you know, you don't have many more choices at this point. As U.S. president, the world is expecting you to take a much more direct role in finding some kind of mediated settlement.
You know, one of the interesting things about George Bush, as we cover him, is you may agree with what he does, you may not agree with what he does, but he's usually very quickly decisive, and he's usually extremely clear. Think about how it only took a few days after September 11th for him to articulate the Bush Doctrine of pursuing terrorists and those who harbor them, and then repeating those lines very clearly and following up with policy very, very clearly. The first time that has really fallen apart has been over the Mideast issue. Where the policy has been more of a muddle. The debate within the administration has been visible there for all of us to see, if not happening right out in public, then very, very close to the surface. And that is very unusual for this White House and suggests that, in fact, they still haven't quite figured out how to do this. And I think it is because of all of those conflicting pressures.
And will it be, David, just briefly, watching their discomfort with our own looking in on that, and that indecision that perhaps prompts faster action?
Could be. I mean, they began to move yesterday after probably 3 or 4 days of press coverage that suggested that, in fact, they haven't decided where they're going. And this is a White House, I think, that is uncomfortable when it picks up the newspapers in the morning and reads that.
Right.
I think you'll see some of that. It will be interesting over the next 48 to 72 hours. We all leave late this afternoon for Crawford, Texas, where President Bush is having Tony Blair in for the weekend. On Saturday, they're doing a full press conference. It'll be the first time that he has really been subject to questions since this latest raft of violence. And that will probably be the moment where he is going to have to make some fairly definitive statements.
David, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
David Sanger, White House correspondent for the New York Times. I'm going to turn to Henry Siegman now, as I said, Middle East expert, senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York City. Mr. Siegman, you have been saying that the president needs to take a risk here. Are we about to watch that happen?
Well, that's not clear for reasons just indicated by David Sanger. This president is on the receiving end of conflicting advice, each point of view, and these points of view are mutually inconsistent, each point of view has very impassioned advocates and people who are very close to him. It is not clear that the president has resolved the issue. It is not clear that he's prepared finally to settle on a clear course of action, understanding the costs, but determined to implement it. And we're going to have to wait and see. I do not preclude that we will see some more zigs and zags before U.S. policy is clarified and remains on a consistent course.
But if we talk about the costs, he and his people must also be determining the cost of not getting more involved at this point.
Yes, indeed. And it is precisely that cost that has reopened the issue. Because, again, as indicated earlier by David and yourself, until now, the administration had calculated that whatever the cost, it can absorb it. It can deal with it. And hopefully, for the sake of American interests in the region, and perhaps even more so for the sake of the adversaries themselves, hopefully that has come to an end. But again, I do not know for a fact, and I would hesitate to say that it's clear that this administration now is embarking on a course to which it will stick.
I want to talk a little further on in the hour with you, Henry, about the American interest that you alluded to there, but I want to turn at this point to Gene Kirkpatrick, who's senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, known to us as former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. I know you're watching what's happening with considerable interest, Ms. Kirkpatrick, and I'm interested in knowing, after having served, as you did under President Reagan, whether or not you see some example that Mr. Reagan could be showing for Mr. Bush here in the determination with which he applied to the Soviet Union in the last years of that regime. Should Mr. Bush be taking some lessons from that time?
And I was thinking about that yesterday, as a matter of fact. And I must say, I don't see clear lessons which President Reagan would probably have drawn in such a situation. President Reagan believed very greatly in strength and in maintaining America's strength. I think President George W. Bush believes also in maintaining America's strength. President Reagan believed very strongly in not becoming involved in any conflict unless he was quite certain that he had both the significant support of a significant portion of the Congress and also the American people. And but I don't think President Reagan was ever in quite a situation like George W. Bush is. I think no one has mentioned what I consider the most difficult aspect of the Bush plight, as it were, of the Bush situation today. And it is his clear, I mean crystal clear, commitment to fighting terrorism, you know, wherever, whenever, however it appears. And he's not only stated this, but he's reiterated it. He stated it, of course, after 9/11, and has reiterated it several times since. And with that is, in conflict with that, if you will, is the very critically important role that groups identified as terrorist groups by the U.S. Department of State, namely Hamas, you know, for example, and Islamic Jihad, and one could say the Al-Aqsa Brigades. I don't know whether they've been identified by the State Department. Play in this current conflict, and I mean, these are clearly terrorist groups, and it would be very difficult. As a matter of fact, it would really be sort of impossible for the president, I think, to say that the United States has a right to oppose terrorists wherever they are and whenever and however, but that Israel has no right to oppose terrorists who have, in fact, engaged, not only engaged again and again in attacks against Israel, above all in the form of suicide bombing, but not only that, but also have acknowledged those attacks and claimed credit for them. And I think this conflict is at the very base of the President Bush's deep, personal difficulty with this issue and situation. And I think he is he's in a bind.
Henry.
Yes.
Sorry, I heard you trying to speak there. I wondered if you wanted to pick up that point.
Yes, I did want to follow up on that. I fully agree with this point that at the heart of the president's dilemma is this seeming contradiction. But one of the roles of leadership is to be able to make valid distinctions if those distinctions are indeed real and defensible. And the issue here, it seems to me, is not Israel's right to respond and to fight terrorism. I don't think there's anyone who questions the right, indeed the responsibility and obligation of a government to protect its citizens against this kind of butchery. The issue, rather, is how you do that. If you do it in ways that only increase the threat of terrorism, that's destructive. And in this particular case, if the Palestinians are not offered a clear, nonviolent approach to their goal, their goal, of course, being the end of the occupation and the establishment of a Palestinian state. If this government, history is history, but this particular government, if it says to them, as Sharon indeed has said over and over again, that the best you Palestinians can hope for is some small enclave within the West Bank, 40 or 50% of the territories, more than that you cannot get, then they are not fighting terror. They're not dealing with terrorism in an effective way, but rather in a counterproductive way.
Connection listeners, we're at 1-800-423-8255, and we're talking about the dilemmas, the directions, and the decisions that face the Bush administration at this point in the Middle East. Gene Kirkpatrick, thank you for being with us on the program.
Thanks for asking.
Gene Kirkpatrick is a former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, and we're continuing when we come back after the break with Bill Quandt and Henry Siegman. This is The Connection from NPR.
Sunny skies at 10:22.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio, and on this day, when so much attention is focused on Bethlehem, Nablus, decisions that have to be made by the Israeli Defense Forces as they move further into the Palestinian territories, Palestinians who have taken refuge inside the Church of the Nativity and continue to work with Yasser Arafat in Ramallah, yet all attention continues to come back to Washington, and whether or not at such a crucial time, more isn't required of the Bush administration. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. With me on the program today, Henry Siegman, Middle East expert, senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York City. Joining us now, Bill Quandt, professor of government and foreign affairs at the University of Virginia. And Bill's a former member of the National Security Council during the Nixon and Carter administrations. Bill, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
What difference, in your view, would it make if the Bush administration decided to make this its number one priority and get boldly involved in the Middle East now?
Well, I think it could make a tremendous difference. Of course, in this business, there's no guarantee of success. Administrations sometimes launch initiatives that don't succeed, and I think one has to be realistic about the prospects of an overall solution right now to the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians. Nonetheless, there's no third party with more influence than the United States, both with Israel and, frankly, with the Palestinians and other Arab countries. But it's not just a matter of getting more involved. It's also how we would get involved. If we just keep repeating Tenet, Mitchell, simultaneously, sequentially, which is pretty much what we've heard in the last couple of weeks, it doesn't change the dynamic of this conflict. It's just going to keep on going. We need to engage with something new that will change the nature of kind of expectations and behavior. And maybe we can take a little time to talk about what some new substantive elements could be in an American proposal, because I think it is more than just activity. The president can man the phones and say the same things he's been saying in the past couple of weeks, and just being more active by itself won't really bring about any change.
We know at this point that Colin Powell, Secretary of State, is due to go to Europe to meet with leaders there and has said that he would make time to go to the Middle East, meet whoever, talk with whoever. We're just getting word over the news wires that President George Bush is, in fact, dispatching Secretary of State Powell to the Middle East, perhaps as early as today. Let's just have a word from Powell about what his view on the situation is now. We actually don't have that, but Bill, let's go back to that, because specifically on the point that you're talking about, activity in and of itself is not enough. So Powell goes today to the Middle East. Does that mean that we're looking at a shift, or is that not what you're talking about here?
It certainly could mean that we're looking at a shift. It's striking that he was quite reticent about getting directly engaged just a short time ago. And I hope that if he does get engaged, he brings to the discussions something that's a bit new. I'm getting kind of tired of hearing Tenet Mitchell as if that's the sum total of the policies that we can imagine. I think it now we have an opportunity, we have to test it, broadening the political dialogue to include countries like Saudi Arabia, who have now signed on to a formula that says they're prepared to make peace with Israel in conditions of a comprehensive negotiation. That should be put to the test, and it helps to change the framework from just Israel versus Palestinians, which is a terribly fraught relationship right now, to a set of relations that might be a little bit more hopeful, including for many Israelis, the prospect that if they do make the hard concessions they ultimately will have to make in negotiations with the Palestinians, that they have the prospect of getting peace with their Arab neighbors and peace with positive content to it. So that should be one element. And I think Powell can also bring to the table a strong sense that there is international consensus and support, Europeans, Russians, moderate Arab states, for getting back to a kind of Madrid-like formula, kind of convening the leaders of the key parties, including Israelis and Palestinians, to kind of reaffirm a commitment to a political process that will both end the violence and end the occupation and provide a peaceful avenue for establishing a viable Palestinian state. If he could say that on this trip, then I would be prepared to say American policy is really moving in a new direction that has some hope and a very positive direction.
It's in part, I guess, Henry Siegman, a matter of offering some kind of political context for Yasser Arafat to change his mind, to say, now I have a reason to speak out against Hamas and Al-Aqsa and work for something. Henry, are you there?
Can you hear me?
Yes, I hear you now. Go ahead.
Okay. First, let me say I agree with everything Bill Quandt just said, and I usually do. But I'd like to stress a particular point. These various mechanisms that even the previous administration, but especially this administration, has been wedded to, Tenet, Mitchell, certainly in the case of this administration, have served as an alternative, as a substitute for tough policy. And I fully agree with what is implicit in Bill's remarks, that you cannot have replacements for policy. There is no trick. There is no way to avoid making good policy and pursuing it. There's no guarantee of success, of course. But at least you have clear goals and you go after them. Tenet and Mitchell are meaningless, are irrelevant in the absence of an American determination to get the job done. The question is, how do you define getting the job done? And it seems to me that there is no way of avoiding a clear American commitment that to the goal of the process, and that goal is establishing a Palestinian state, essentially, with some minor changes along the pre-67 borders, and establishing a capital for this Palestinian state in the Arab sections of East Jerusalem. Until we are prepared to formulate that kind of broad guideline for the process itself, for the peace process itself, I don't think meetings, even by the Secretary of State or even by the President himself, will produce any results. We first must do the tough thing, and so far it hasn't been done.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. We're going to Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Lewis is joining us. Hi, Lewis.
Good morning.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. My question is, why is America not taking the lead in trying to broker peace in the Middle East, seeing that we are one of the only remaining superpowers? We're supposed to be standing up for freedom of speech, freedom of press, freedom of life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. Why? And we have come out to condone Israelis labeling the Palestinians and the freedom fighters there as terrorists, when that idea is actually, and that term is very debatable. To the Palestinians, they see themselves as using the only means that they have at their availability, since they don't have tanks, they don't have helicopters, they don't have an established army. They're trying to overcome what they see as an obscene occupation. But America continually says, we agree with Israel trying to protect itself. But we're not condemning Israel for banning ambulances, keeping the Red Cross out, kicking journalists out, water cannoning peace activists, banning European diplomats from coming in and trying to broker peace. It seems very hypocritical, it seems very one-sided, and this is what we need to be focusing on. No one, the rest of the world is looking at this and saying, why is America being so one-sided on this issue?
Let's ask Bill Quandt to speak to this, because Bill was a part of the Camp David Accords and also later conversations that bring in, as Henry was saying, the other parties, the Jordanians, the Egyptians, the Lebanese, and is that part of getting beyond what Lewis is saying, that this seeming imbalance in the United States supporting one side yet still trying to be the mediator? Bill?
Well, I think George W. Bush made up his mind early on in his administration that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict was pretty much a hopeless case. He'd seen Clinton devote a lot of time and effort to it, and I think he probably concluded that non-involvement was the best course for him. It's non-controversial. The politics surrounding this issue in the United States can become quite poisonous. I don't think it actually has yet, but if President Bush were to stand up and take a stance that is at all like Lewis suggested, that is pointing the finger at terrorism and violence that we disapprove of on whichever side it manifests itself, of course half the Congress would the next day denounce him. And this is not a president who wants to take a lot of political flack, particularly if he doesn't think it's going to achieve any goal. I think he's basically timid. He perhaps remembers what happened to his father, who tangled with Prime Minister Shamir. But forget about psychoanalyzing the president and his motives. The question is, what would actually help now? And I think there are two clear messages that have to come across to appeal to mainstream peace-oriented people in both societies. And I honestly think there are still Israelis and Palestinians who, in the right circumstances, would be happy to get back to peace negotiations. I think Israelis do have to hear that we understand and their concern about suicide bombings in their civilian areas, and we deploy those. I don't think that those suicide bombers count, in my book at least, as freedom fighters. I'd say something different about the acts that are carried out in the occupied territories. But the attacks against civilians inside Israel, I think we have every right to say are deplorable and a Palestinian Authority should stop. I think at the same time, the president has to say, and the Palestinians have every right to look forward to, in the near future, to an end of the occupation through peaceful negotiations, which will establish a viable Palestinian state along well-known lines of American policy that repeated administrations have supported, 242, essentially withdrawal to the 1967 lines, but to do it through peaceful means. And I think that would have a tremendous impact on both parties.
Lewis, is it a timidity that you're seeing, a tentativeness in Washington that you'd like to see changed?
Yes, exactly. I mean, we should be leaders, a nation of leaders. There's no reason why we cannot get in there and say, you know, Israel, Palestine, you know, come to this table and let's sit down and hash this out. You know, I completely understand how Israelis would be furious at someone going into a hotel during a holiday and blowing people up. But I can also understand how the Palestinians feel like they have had land taken from them. I feel like how they they're not allowed the freedom in their homeland that they feel they're entitled to by birth. They feel that they don't have the resources available to them, and I can understand the furor that people who have nothing will pick up a rock and throw it, or they'll say, I'm going to be a martyr to my people and take out as many of the enemy as possible.
But you're saying to the president, Lewis, get engaged, get on this.
Get engaged, do something. Stop sitting back on your can and and do something to straighten this out before more people are killed.
Thank you so much for your call.
Thank you.
1-800-423-8255. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. And we're going to Hampton, Virginia. Julie's joining us. Hi, Julie.
Hi. It's good speaking with you.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks. My question is sort of a question comment. I'm having a hard time understanding why us as Americans can expect our president and can expect the Israeli people to deal with the Palestinian people, these particular suicide bombers, as anything but terrorists. We would never allow people in our country to come in and do what these people have done and deal with them as anything but criminals.
It's something that Henry was talking about a little bit earlier, Julie, in the difficulty that the United States has with definitions here. You know, that the U.S. will not refer to Arafat as a terrorist, though they will talk about suicide bombings as terrorist act. Henry, does the United States need to sharpen its explanation of how it uses words like terrorism? Is it being caught on that kind of definitional double bind?
Well, I fully support an unqualified condemnation of suicide bombings that target innocent civilians as the most obscene kind of violence and terrorism, and we need to condemn it. But I think that if our policy stops at the level of condemnation and pointing fingers, we achieve nothing. We have a responsibility as the greatest world power, precisely because we have the capacity to do it. We have a responsibility to do it.
To do what? To say that Arafat is a terrorist?
No,
to say that
no,
the circumstances
no, no, no.
are exactly the same? Sorry, go ahead.
No. What we have the responsibility of doing is pursuing and getting the parties to agree to actions that end the violence. Simply to condemn and to spend a lot of time on defining the actions of different people on either side. For example, the U.S. should also be defining what Israel is doing when it is now engaging in a massive assault on Palestinian civilian institutions and civilians. That, too, is a form of terror. But my point is that if all we do is engage in that kind of condemnation, we're doing nothing. This is not the role of a great superpower. What we need to do is to try to define clearly the purpose of the process, what its goal is, how the parties can get there, and then use our muscle to see to it that the parties do, in fact, get onto a road. And we have to help define the roadmap so that those goals are achievable.
Would the muscle
if
include...
All we do,
would the
I'm
muscle
sorry.
If all,
yeah.
You go ahead.
No, I was ending this exhortation by saying that if all we do is exhort, then we really aren't contributing much.
I was just wondering, when you refer to muscle, whether you're talking about American soldiers as well in the Middle East.
I think we have to be prepared to do that as well. Absolutely.
Julie, the ideas that Henry's explaining, is that what you'd like to hear from the administration? Get away from the words, get away from definitions, get involved.
Actually, I'm not sure. I'm not sure what my husband's military, so this is, it hits very close to home to me when you discuss possibly sending troops into such an incredibly unstable situation. And I'm not completely sure that the United States has the ability to go in here and solve this problem. It doesn't seem like they have a respect for us at the current point in time where we're going to be able to go in there and accomplish this.
Well, neither did Al-Qaeda, but nobody hesitated at that point.
I don't have a response for that.
Yeah. No, I'm not looking necessarily for hard answers, but they are questions. They are dilemmas. I want to thank you for your call, Julie.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. And we're talking about the pressure that is growing on Washington to become more involved in the Middle East, not necessarily with words or demands, but creating some kind of consensus or political context that gets the sides together talking. 1-800-423-8255. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
For The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. With me on the program today, Bill Quandt, professor of government and foreign affairs at the University of Virginia, former member of the National Security Council during the Nixon and Carter administrations, was advisor to Carter, in fact, when Anwar Sadat and Menachem Begin went to Camp David in 1978, which led to 12 days of talk and the Camp David Accords of March 1979. Also with me on the program, Henry Siegman. He is Middle East expert and senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York City. We're going next to Boston. Richard's on the line. Hello, Richard.
Hi, nice to be with you. You have a very fine show today. Some really lucid comments from your guests. I would like to ask both of them a question, both Bill Quandt and Henry Siegman. This relates to the question of how we get to the sort of new imagination or the sort of new a tool for trying to build peace in the region. Bill Quandt mentioned the Madrid model or something like the Madrid model. But the problem is we have an immediate question right now, and that is how you establish a level of calm that's requisite to engaging in that kind of diplomacy. The last caller talked about the introduction of U.S. troops. This question remains a very significant one because unless we can establish that level of security, we're not going anywhere.
Okay, Richard.
And may I make one other point, and that is that Sharon's endgame very clearly seems to be to destroy anything that looks like, smells like, or walks like Oslo, including, of course, the PA apparatus. So this raises the real prospect of a major confrontation between the U.S. and Sharon.
Let's take, if we can, the first part of your question. Bill Kwan, I'll start with you on how we get to that new platform of communication that we've been talking about.
Well, I wish I had an easy answer. I think it's going to be very difficult because I think up until today, Prime Minister Sharon has pretty much felt he has a green light from Washington to finish his military operations, although I must say I have no idea what he thinks the end game of this military strategy is going to be. At some point, Israel's still going to have to figure out how to coexist alongside a very angry Palestinian population. And I don't think reoccupying and staying in the Palestinian towns and cities is going to be a formula for peace and calm. So at some point, Israel's going to have to disengage from where it now is, and I think the sooner the better. I think it's actually very dangerous to destroy the basic underpinnings of a Palestinian society and, you know, schools and security outposts and all the rest, because the Palestinians at some point are going to have to be able to act as a partner in negotiations with Israel, and they can't do that in conditions of anarchy.
Does that mean that the Jordanians, the Egyptians, the Lebanese, that drawing in other Arab countries, neighboring Arab countries, would be key to establishing that type of communication with Arafat, which isn't working now?
Well, politically, that might help, since Sharon seems to be quite determined to ignore and humiliate and isolate Arafat. There needs to be somebody who can articulate Palestinian positions, and I think it has to be Palestinians, but it can be supported by other Arabs. I guess the other question that you posed, and it's a tough one, is what role American, perhaps European, perhaps even other kinds of peacekeeping forces or peace observers might play. And in the midst of the fighting, of course, it's almost impossible to imagine injecting forces in today's conditions. But let's say that a few days from now, Sharon says, okay, I've done what I set out to do and taught them another lesson, as if they hadn't had plenty of lessons taught already, and I'm ready to pull back, then I think there is a need for some kind of presence that is credible in the eyes of Palestinians and Israelis to go in at least as monitors and peacekeepers in certain sensitive areas. Particularly Ramallah looks like it's going to be an extremely sensitive area. But I'm not sure we can persuade the Israelis to accept that. However, I think the alternatives are all worse.
Henry Siegman, what about American presence that is more credible than Anthony Zinni? Not to criticize him, but he's not as well known as Colin Powell, as George Bush Sr., as James Baker, as Bill Clinton. All these names have been raised as possible vanguards of a new conversation. Would that be a part of getting to the platform that Richard's talking about?
Well, I think that may help, but I would repeat what I said earlier. The problem today is not the level of representation. The problem is the absence of a political framework.
Mm-hmm.
And you can send in God himself, he will not be able to deliver.
But George Bush Sr. would be perhaps in a better position to help create that new political framework than someone like Zinni, who is taking more specific and direct orders from Washington, no?
Well, exactly. I fully agree with that. My point is that first there has to be policy. First there has to be agreement on a political framework which gives not just one side, but both sides hope that their most essential objectives are on the table and there is a path, a nonviolent path, towards achieving that. If that is not, and that only the president can establish. Now, if he clearly establishes that that kind of policy and that kind of political framework, then I would not put it past Zinni to accomplish the mission. But it would certainly help if someone who has greater political weight, who's better known, and is closer to the president himself, were to represent the president.
Okay. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Richard, thank you for your call. We're going to Somerville, Massachusetts now. And Barbara's joining us. Hi, Barbara.
Good morning. I just wanted to put into the mix here that there is a growing movement of grassroots Jewish groups in the U.S. that believe that the occupation is itself the main obstacle to peace in the region, And we've been lobbying our legislators and trying to get some visibility in the media, which is very difficult to do because all of them are completely mesmerized by the very powerful pro-Israel lobby. But we believe that U.S. policy needs to change in the direction of pressing Israel to end the occupation immediately. The U.S. is already profoundly involved in this conflict. We have provided $3.75 billion in aid every year since Oslo began, and most of that goes to F-16 fighters, Apache helicopters, and all the weapons that are being used in the territories. We have essentially funded and made possible this colonial occupations, one of the few continuing colonial occupations.
But Barbara, if we're talking about a quarrel between who gets the ear of the people who write the checks in Washington, mm-hmm. is it a question of who's got the numbers, who's got the weight, and do you see that shifting?
You know, I see that shifting. There's a lot of work being done on the ground. The problem is that the pro-Israel lobby is very well organized and has been for years, and there's really an intensification of a dissenting view that has happened over the past year and a half since the Intifada started. So people on the ground are really trying to get their footing and press this view and get attention. It's hard to get the ear of legislators. It's hard to get visibility in the media because of the lock that the pro-Israeli lobby has, which isn't, by the way, just comprised of U.S. Jews. It's also comprised of many Christian Zionists as well. But the point is that people have been saying on your show that we absolutely need new strategies. A new strategy would be for the U.S. government to take a position against the occupation. We are the people providing the money, and we can put our money where our mouth is. That's
okay.
What this administration needs to do, to actually put sanctions on the Israeli government.
Barbara, let me ask our guests whether or not that's something that is in the conversation in Washington now.
I would be very surprised if this administration is thinking of direct sanctions of any form. I do think the language that Barbara suggests, that is, of focusing on the occupation as something that must be brought to an end as part of a move toward peace in the region, is essential to our credibility, just as we insist on the end of terrorism as a means to achieve peace. I think those statements now have to be made simultaneously by any credible spokesman for the United States, that we oppose terrorism and we oppose the continuation of occupation indefinitely, that there has to be a means undertaken to bring about the end of the occupation through peaceful means. Now, we're not going to do it, I think, by sanctions. Congress will never go along with it. This administration would never think about it. But there are things short of what you normally think of as sanctions that we could do and I think should consider. For example, we provide, as Barbara implied and said, the F-16s, the Apache helicopters. We provide those under legislation that says that says explicitly that they can only be used in Israel's self-defense. I think you can stretch the meaning of self-defense pretty far, but I don't think you can stretch it as far as it is now being stretched. And at whatever point we decide Israel is using American military equipment beyond the bounds of self-defense, for example, and continuing the occupation of the Palestinian areas, we can say we are simply not going to allow it to go on. And at that point, by law, military aid to Israel has to be suspended until the American military equipment is once again used in compliance with American law.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Barbara, thanks very much for your call. We're going now to Boston, and Cyrilla's joining us. Hello, Cyrilla.
Hi.
Hi. Go ahead, Cyrilla.
Hi. I have a question. Right now, the United States is the only friend Israel has. What would happen if the U.S. was to denounce Israel and just have no contact with him?
It's not likely to happen, though, is it, Cyrilla?
Right. It's not likely to happen, but if it were to happen, what would happen to Israel?
Well, let's take it in that form, but also in perhaps a more gradual question, similar to what Barbara was saying, whether or not the United States were to become more critical of Israel or be more demanding in terms of how Israel managed its military policy. And Henry Siegmund, can you speak to Cyrilla on this one?
Yes, and let me combine this. Let me place it within the context of the previous question as well.
Mm-hmm.
Well, first of all, the United States will always affirm and should always affirm the importance of Israel's security, of its integrity, of its survival, and of its own unquestioned friendship to the State of Israel, not to the policies of particular governments of Israel, but to the State of Israel itself. And that is a very critical distinction. And the U.S. will always continue to do so because it is in this country's interests to do so. Now, it is in the area of interests where change in policy can occur if you begin dealing in a more open and honest way. What will change, what will turn around this this battleship of U.S. policy, I say battleship or airplane carriers, the metaphor suggests how slowly policy tends to change. But what will change it, I think, again, is not because groups that oppose the Israel lobby attack them and change Congress's mind. That's not going to happen. What will change U.S. policy, and it may indeed, as we speak, be undergoing change, is an unavoidable and inescapable understanding of how American interests in the region are being damaged. And when you read the papers and you look at your television screens and listen to radio, of course, you begin to understand that regimes that are very important to fundamental American interests in the region are now at risk. They can fall. There are riots and demonstrations virtually throughout the entire Middle East. And the possibility of a radical destabilization of the entire region is now very, very real. Now, that kind of reality check is what, in the end, I think can and hopefully will change how the United States deals with this problem.
Cyrilla, thanks for your call. Bill Quandt, is the picture now one that needs to include those neighboring Arab states in terms of looking at the future of the region?
I said earlier, and I will repeat, that I think one of the new elements in the equation is the more forward stance of the Saudis, who typically are the most reticent of players in the Middle East game, to say openly that they are ready for real peace with Israel, including normal relations. We shouldn't just scoff at that and say it's irrelevant because it somehow was extracted in an interview by a New York Times correspondent. It now has been reaffirmed by the Crown Prince and endorsed by all of the main Arab states. In fact, all of them say they support it. It has to be put to the test, but it is a new element, and for many Israelis, it's one more reason to think that peace might actually be advantageous to the State of Israel. They may still be suspicious of Palestinian motives, but
Bill,
if they could...
I have to interrupt you. We're out of time.
I understand.
Thanks to both of you for being with me.
You're welcome.
Henry Siegman, Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, Bill Quandt, Professor of Government and Foreign Affairs at the University of Virginia. Earlier in the program, we talked with David Sanger at the New York Times and Jean Kirkpatrick, former ambassador to the UN. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company.